Well, good afternoon, everyone, and thank you so much for coming. This is very special. It's not the first time I've introduced a lecture, but I'm introducing it the first of what we think is a new cycle of annual lectures. So that's a very special moment for the Voltaire Foundation. We've had for 25 years or more, we've had an annual lecture called the Bestman Lecture that I now run with Avi, who's here, that where we invite Enlightenment historians and literary critics to come and give a talk. But in recent years, for lots of reasons that we know about, the Voltaire Foundation has been moving more and more towards digital research. When I first became director, I was given to sell on my first day in the office a CD-ROM. That's a bit historic, isn't it? And then we produced a database in the early 2000s, Electronic Enlightenment. Now we're working on digitizing from scratch, in a sense, the 200-odd volumes of the complete works of Voltaire. So there's always been, although we've been primarily a paper publisher until recently, we've always been doing digital research. And over the last few years, particularly working with Glenn, the digital research has become terribly important. As we've accumulated more data, there's been more opportunities and more excitement in exploiting that data and thinking about how to use it. So it seemed that in the evolution of the Voltaire Foundation, this is a good moment for us to sort of make the point by having an annual lecture. And last year we launched a new online open access journal, Digital Enlightenment Studies. And I can't say take a copy with you because it's online, but you can take with you a postcard, a beautifully designed postcard outside. So please have a look. It's a fantastic journal. It's establishing a whole area of research, and it contains wonderful articles, including one by Mikko and his team in Helsinki who are here. And if you're inspired to send us an article, we'd like that too. So we've begun by founding this new online journal, open access. It looks beautiful. And we're now in the same spirit, beginning a new series of annual lectures. It's a huge pleasure to have Glenn to give this first lecture in the series. I think we met probably before, but the first time we met and worked together for a long time was when you were Mellon Fellow in Digital Humanities, funded by the Mellon Foundation in 2011 to 2013. And although you then left Oxford and you went to the ANU, where you were at the Centre for DH Research, and you've, of course, before that and since then, you've been working in Chicago on the Artful Project, producing amazing 18th century digital resources, and not least the Encyclopédie. And since 2018, Glenn has been Professor of DH in the French department at the Sorbonne. But in all that time, you've always had a connection with what we've maintained a connection with the Voltaire Foundation. And you're currently, since 2021, the Astra Foundation Research Fellow in Digital Humanities. And I also want to say, as I was celebrating the way that the Voltaire Foundation is moving into digital research, I do want to pay particular thanks to the Astra Foundation, who's represented here tonight by Elizabeth. The Astra Foundation, four years ago, made us an extraordinary grant, which has enabled us to really establish ourselves in this area. And it was a really transformational grant, which has enabled us first to establish ourselves in the area of digital research and to employ lots of younger researchers and to invite younger people. So it's played a really key part in helping us develop in that direction and encourage young researchers and scholars in Oxford. We're incredibly grateful. Some of our researchers are here tonight, and Glenn has been the Astra Foundation Research Fellow and has been a key player in helping us direct that that new direction of our research. I also should mention Glenn's publications. He published his thesis, which was on the literary theory of Peggy, published by Oxford. I know that you've edited a special issue of humanities research on political vocabularies. We worked together on a book on Voltaire's correspondence and readings of quotation in Voltaire's correspondence. This is a lovely book, Digitizing Enlightenment, that you edited with Glenn Rowe in our monograph series published by Oxford. I'm here to advertise, obviously. We have copies on sale afterwards. And recently, I think Glenn's published a book called Observer la vie littéraire, which you published with Garnier with Didier Alexandre. So there's a hugely impressive list of publications, not to mention immensely distinguished articles. Glenn and his colleagues from Chicago, several of them are here, Robert's here, Clovis is here, have done really pioneering work in thinking about data reuse and citation strategy in the Encyclopédie and the Encyclopédiste. And some of those things, I think, may come back into this lecture today. I'm not sure. I haven't yet asked Glenn what he's going to talk about. But crucially, Glenn's also just pulled off the magic for every researcher, an ERC Consolidated Grant, currently, I think, in year two, which has a great title and a great logo, Modelling Enlightenment. It's modern, I should have said. Modern. Modelling Enlightenment, Reassembling Networks of Modernity Through Data-Driven Research. So the idea here is to use big data and to use that, to shape that with through experiment, to try and remap, I think, well, I don't speak for Glenn, but I think the attempt will be to remap the way we conventionally think about French Enlightenment and French Enlightenment writing. I'm not sure how much today's lecture will draw on that, we're going to see, but you have a great title, The Poetics of Text Reuse, Digital Intertextuality in the 18th Century Archive. Glenn, it's a fantastic pleasure to have you here. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much, Nicholas, and thank you all to coming. It's a really genuine and great pleasure to be here today to give this first annual lecture in digital enlightenment studies, which is, as Nicholas just mentioned, a field in which we're heavily invested, and that collectively at the Voltaire Foundation in Chicago, thanks to the Astra Foundation, at the Sorbonne, sort of a bit all over, we're committed to promoting this new field of research and to present to the world both in the form of this public lecture, but also the new open access journal that Nicholas mentioned. The raison d'être for both of these initiatives is the realization that this field of study, digital approaches to the 18th century in general, has reached a certain maturity, and digital collections a certain critical mass, which warrants and welcomes new scholarship and forms of academic outreach. This is not to say that digital research has fully and finally been accepted by the humanities mainstream, but simply that we're perhaps on better footing today than at any time in the past two decades. Certain barriers remain, not just for digital 18th century studies, but for the wider digital humanities world, in general, who are still in some venues kept at a disciplinary distance. It is often said, for example, that DH lacks sufficient theoretical grounding. It's just a new positivism, all praxis, no theory. And this is somewhat true if you attack literary and historical questions from a purely computational perspective. One text is the same as another, whether it's Proust's novel or a grocery list once reduced to ones and zeros. If, however, you start from a theoretical framework, such as intertextuality, as we'll see today, or the idea of modeling as an epistemological exercise, to follow Willard McCarty, then the conversation between human and machine becomes all the more engaging. And this is especially true in our current age of so-called artificial intelligence, where large language models capable of reading whole universes of texts and generating human-like responses based on an almost infinite archive are in dire need of theoretical, not to mention ethical, grounding from the humanities. These models are the fever dream, I would argue, of post-structuralism. And we need scholars conversant in theory, with a capital T, to understand these new artificial textualities. What I'd like to present to you today, then, is perhaps surprisingly much less technical and much more theoretical in terms of scope. And this is quite intentional on my part, in a modest effort to demonstrate that thinking with and thinking through computational methods and approaches to literary historical data can lead to real insights and uncover the rich complexity of humanistic generative intelligences that are all too often hidden in our ever-growing digital archives. So one such computational approach that we've been using for years at the University of Chicago and elsewhere is the automatic detection of text reuse. And this is, as I said, an old in computational terms, goes back to 2002, at least in its first official naming of text reuse. And it's quite prosaic in its definition. It's the reuse of existing written sources in the creation of a new text. And in this paper, they talk about a sort of similarity spectrum where you have information retrieval, which is the classic document retrieval methods that go back to the 60s and 70s, bag of words models, if that means anything to you, where we think about how documents are related to each other in a sort of semantic similarity space. Text reuse is somewhere in the middle between the two. And then on the right is the near duplicate detection, which we know and love as plagiarism detection in all of its glory. To think about this theoretically, we might say that text reuse is a form of intertextuality, and you could, which is a theory that comes out of the 60s and 70s in France. Julia Kristeva is the first to use the term. She uses it as a translation of Bakhtin's notion of dialogism, and then it sort of takes off in the tel quel circle from there. You could have a sort of conservative approach to intertextuality, which would be the Harold Bloom school of influence, where the criticism of the art of knowing, the hidden roads that go from poem to poem, where poetic geniuses sort of have to grapple with the great giants of the past, and they necessarily borrow from these predecessors to assert their own poetic authority. More radically is the Bakhtian school of intertextuality, where every text becomes a sort of intertext, where other texts are always present in it at various levels in more or less recognizable forms, texts from the previous culture and those from the surrounding culture. Every text then becomes a new fabric or tissue of quotations from the past. Between these two, I wouldn't say oppositions, but between these two views, I take a more middle road, not surprisingly either, more Genettian in my take of intertextuality. And Genette, in his great work on Palimpsest, defines it as a relationship of co-presence between two or more texts, that is to say, eidetically, and most often by the actual presence of one text in another. In its most explicit and literal form, it is the traditional practice of citation, which I now put in the middle of our spectrum, with or without inverted commas, with or without precise reference, when a less explicit and less canonical form, that of plagiarism, which is an undeclared but still literal borrowing. Clearly, this today we think of text reuse a bit, it's a bit sad actually, as a form of plagiarism, and almost exclusively as a form of plagiarism. And this is because we have this notion that words belong to certain authors and can't be reused without their authorization. This has played out recently in academia, and if you'd followed the poor plight of Claudine Gay, the first African-American woman president of Harvard, who was fired ostensibly for plagiarism, this article in The Guardian tells you exactly what a broad spectrum this notion of plagiarism is. And a certain Barbara Glatt, who is responsible for the Turnitin software, if you've ever used it, you know about it, can be direct, copying or something, word for word without attribution, indirect, the wholesale theft of ideas, mosaic, and this is a term that will come back today, hold it in your mind, changing some words while copying others, or even an honest mistake, an error of omission or an execution. All things Gay was accused to have done, even as she continues to stand by her scholarship. These are all things I think we all do as scholars. And it's once you move into the legalistic realm of plagiarism that text reuse becomes a problematic practice. But in the same article, if you move down, the professor of linguistic anthropology at Notre Dame, Susan Bloom, says that there's a sort of continuum, that it's too cut and dry to think of plagiarism just as this theft of other people's words, and that somewhere between originality and complete copying, there's a language and culture that moves into the middle. And that it is in this language and culture that perhaps text reuse inhabits this middle ground. And I would say that that's exactly the case in the 18th century, where they didn't yet have this notion of plagiarism as the theft of another author's word, and that the culture of citation gravitated between these two poles of originality and imitation. And in a nutshell, the 18th century clearly is dominated still at the beginning of the 18th century by this classical notion of imitation, which aesthetically was the model for hundreds of years. And it's predicated on this notion that the value of a work came from its conformity to the great works of the past. And it was through these works that we could gain access to truth, beauty, nature, all of these higher level ideas of which the ancients were somehow the strict equivalent. So speaking of Virgil, for example, Pope remarks that perhaps he seemed above the critic's law, and but from nature's fountain scorned to draw. But when examined on every part he came, nature and Homer were, he found, the same. From the 18th century onwards, and under the influence of German Romanticism in particular, Literary works were understood as more or less the emanation of what was unique in each individual, their genius. And at the same time, the poet developed a new and immediate relationship with nature, one that didn't have to be based on representations of the ancients. To see this in action, we look to Racine's preface to Britannicus from 1676, where he praised the conformity of his work to that of Tacitus. I had copied my characters after the greatest painter of antiquity, Tacitus, and I was then so full of reading of this excellent historian that there was not a striking feature in my tragedy for which he did not give me the idea. So the model clearly of imitation. Compare this with just 100 years later, with Rousseau, as we know, in his opening volley of the Confessions, where he takes pride in having no predecessor, and indeed no successor. I am creating a work that is without prior example and whose execution will have no imitators. Never mind that generically he borrows his title from St. Augustine, and then thematically he is very much continuing just the work of Montaigne. Montaigne is in fact key here because he demonstrates nicely for us the inherent ambiguity of a writer who is once imbued with the tradition of imitation, inserting his fleur étrangère into his text, and already aware of his identity as a unique and original author, giving himself over to the reader tout entier et tout nu. This notion of originality is inseparable from, I would say, the idea, our idea, or the formation of an idea that we can have of text reuse in the 18th century. And this is a notion that Roland Mortier, for example, has demonstrated as being rather new to the 18th century, and in fact, tributary of the French Enlightenment, this notion of originality as an aesthetic category. And in fact, the word isn't used in French until the very end of the 17th century, by Roger de Pile, talking about the originality of paintings, one of a kind, that can't be copied. Diderot goes on to use it in 1759 as describing someone of a very original character, the originality of the Baron de Gleichen, the Danish minister to France, to Sophie Volant. The first dictionary that enters the lexicon in 1743 in the Dictionnaire de Trévoux, who proudly proclaims that you won't find this word in any other dictionary. So the originality of the definition of originality is here proclaimed. Then to be repeated by a bit laconically in the Dictionnaire de l'Académie Française as just the character of that which is original of people or things. The great encyclopedia, of which there will certainly be questioned today, plays with this semantic shift between original and originality. And it can be seen in these two entries, and this is exactly how the encyclopedia works, which presents both the aesthetics of imitation that is still operative in the 18th century, but also presents it as sort of almost already exhausted by this time. So it's in the first design or authentic instrument of something original, which must serve as a model or an example, something to be copied or imitated. Today, we can hardly find any ancient title of possession, subjugation, etc., that is original. They're only viduments or copies collated from the original. So we've spent our originality. And then the most important thing, of course, in the encyclopédie are the cross-references. So there's a cross-reference to the originality, which we think is by Diderot. And he says, it's a way of doing a common thing in a singular and distinguished way. Originality is very rare. Most people are nothing but copies of each other. The title of original is given in good and bad ways. One can only think of Rousseau there in the sense of an original, both good and bad. So this tension between imitation and originality, between copying, compiling, and eventually plagiarism is central to the Encyclopédie project. As the editors Diderot and D'Alembert were dogged from the outset by accusations of impiety, improper use of authorities, and flat-out plagiarism. D'Alembert responds to their detractors in the editor's introduction to the third volume, where he says, by its very nature, therefore, the Encyclopédie must contain a large number of things that are not new. Among the various works that the Encyclopédie has been accused of borrowing from, other dictionaries have been singled out. The resemblance that is sometimes found between an article in the Encyclopédie and an article in some dictionary is forced by the nature of the subject, especially when the article is short and consists of only a definition of a minor historical fact. This is so true that most dictionaries resemble each other, in a large number of articles because they simply cannot do otherwise. So he's talking here about how you construct a dictionary, how you build it. And typically, practically, how you build it is you started with a list of headwords. And you inherited this list of headwords from other dictionaries. And it was understood that if an older dictionary had a word in it, you probably needed it in your dictionary, whether you thought it was a good idea or not. And Diderot takes his head on. This is quite possibly my favorite article in the 74,000 articles of the Encyclopédie. So here's the article, Aguazima in the Dictionnaire de Trévoux, so the direct predecessor of the Encyclopédie, which tells us it's a plant in Brazil or the islands of South America, and that's about it. Diderot includes this article in the first volume, and he says, he repeats it. He just reuses the first bit of the article, exactly word for word. It's a plant that grows in Brazil, on the islands of South America. This is all that we are told about it. And I would like to know for whom such descriptions are made. It cannot be for the natives of the countries concerned, who are likely to know more about the aguazima than is contained in this description, and who do not need to learn that the aguazima grows in their country. It is as if you said to a Frenchman that the pear tree is a tree that grows in France and Germany, etc. It is not meant for us either, for what do we care that there is a tree in Brazil named aguazima, if all we know about it is its name? What is the point of giving the name? It leaves the ignorant just as they were and teaches the rest of us nothing. If all the same, I mention this plant here, along with several others that are described just as poorly, then it is out of consideration for certain readers who prefer to find nothing in a dictionary article, or even to find something stupid, than to find no article at all. Clearly, Diderot takes some license with this poetics of reuse. But this really gets to the heart of this notion of compilation, of how you had to construct a dictionary in the 18th century. And so if we look at the article compiler, which is by, sort of ironically, one of the great text reusers of the Encyclopédie, the Abbé Mallet, he tells us that it's a writer who does not compose anything of genius, but who is content to collect and repeat what others have written, very much not originality. However, most lexicographers, he tells us, are merely compilers. And he goes on to talk about this notion. And so, but clearly somebody, we would assume Diderot, takes some umbrage with this idea of lexicographers being merely compilers. And there is another cross-reference at the bottom, probably added by Diderot, to plagiarist. And so we get finally to plagiarism. And then it's defined quite clearly at the beginning as a writer who plunders other authors and gives their productions of being their own work. This notion of plundering will come back in one of our titles, which was somewhat badly taken, but it's another story. And then Diderot goes on, and he says, but lexicographers, at least those who deal with the arts and sciences, seem to be exempt from the law, the common laws of mine and yours. They do not claim to build their own land nor to draw from it the materials necessary for the construction of their work. Indeed, the character of a good dictionary, such as we would like this one to be, consists largely in making the use of the best discoveries of others. What we borrow from others, we borrow openly in broad daylight, citing from the writers from which we have drawn. Our status as compilers, and he repeats the term, gives us a right or title to take advantage of everything that we can contribute to the perfection of our purpose, wherever it may be found. If we steal, it is only in imitation of the bees who gather for the profit, for the public good. And this notion of bees that gather, it goes back to the Renaissance, clearly. Montaigne even brings this up, as he's just a bee that's taking nectar from wherever he finds it for the better good. And it cannot exactly be said that we plunder authors, again, back to our title, but that we draw contributions from them for the benefit of letters. So this then is how plagiarism is presented in the Encyclopédie. At once, something that's bad, but given the right context, could be potentially quite good, and in fact, almost a moral duty. And we'll see how this evolves. Voltaire takes this definition back up in his great work of text reuse, the Question sur l'Encyclopédie, in 1772, and he has a sort of mercantile definition of plagiarism. When an author sells the thoughts of another for his own, this petty theft is called plagiarism. We could call plagiarists all the compilers, all the dictionary makers who do no more than repeat opinions, errors, impostures, and truths already printed in previous dictionaries. But they are at least plagiarists of, in good faith. They do not claim credit for invention. They do not even claim to be to have unearthed the materials they have assembled from the ancients. They have merely copied in the laborious compilers of the 16th century. They sell you a quarto on what you already have in folio. Call them booksellers if you like, or not authors. Classify them as second-hand writers rather than plagiarists. This brings to mind the work of Antoine Compagnon on la seconde main de la littérature. Finally, and most interestingly, Marmontel will take up this notion of plagiarism in the Supplément à l'Encyclopédie in 1777. And he is quite clear that it's no great thing to be, it's no great tragedy to be a plagiarist, and it's a sort of literary crime. So it's not a, it's not so serious. For which pedants, envious people, and fools do not fail to put famous writers on trial. So same true today as it was then. Plagiarism is the name they give to a theft of thoughts, and they cry out against this theft as if they themselves were being robbed, or as if they, it were essential to public order and peace that the properties of the mind should be inviolable. Clearly, this is before the law, modern laws on copyright. Anyone who brings to light, either through expression or appropriateness, a thought that was not his own, but which would be otherwise lost, makes it his own by giving it a new being. For oblivion is like nothingness. So here, plagiarism is a positive thing. And in fact, you have to do it. You have a right to posterity to reuse others. In public law, ownership of land is conditional on it not being cultivated, on it it's being cultivated by the owner. And if the owner let it fall, society, which would have the right to demand that he give it up or sell it. The same is true of literature. He who has seized a happy and fruitful idea and does not develop it leaves it as a common property for the first occupant, who will know better than he does how to develop its richness. So this is the sort of notion of plagiarism that we've taken on, this notion of text reuse as a productive and in fact almost moral imperative in the 18th century, which clearly will be destroyed in the laws of 1791, 1793 of copyright and the right of the author. But for most of the 18th century, this sort of free and open plagiaristic text reuse is operative, and nowhere more than in this in the Encyclopédie. And it follows, Diderot, d'Alembert continues in his advertisement, from these reflections that the Encyclopédie must often contain either extracts or even sometimes in full several pieces of the best works of each genre. It is only important to the public that the choice be made with clarity, lumière, and economy. But it is also important for the authors to quote the originals accurately, both to enable the reader to consult them and to give each his due. This is how several of our colleagues have done it. We wish that they had all done so, but in any case, when an article is well done, it is equally enjoyable to read it whichever from whichever hand it comes, and the disadvantage of failing to quote, which is always great in relation to the author, is much less so in relation to the dictionary. This brings us back to this sort of provoked us years ago to think about how we can find these quotations which were marked or sometimes not marked, and these different reuses in the Encyclopédie, and how we could put the Encyclopédie, which is a huge text, which is 74,000 articles, 28 volumes in folio, on this similarity spectrum, to come back to this. So some, and we did tests in information retrieval and similar article comparisons, and we fell, we tried plagiarism detection, it was a bit too strict, and so this is how, all of this is a sort of preface to how we got to investigating automatic text reuse. And we published two articles. Again, I mentioned the first in Plundering Philosophers, and now you see where we get this title from, in 2010, which experimented with all these different sorts of information retrieval. And then there's Something Borrowed, which is more or less outlining how sequence alignment, an approach to text reuse, can be particularly fruitful. For us, and these are slides that I've, in true text reuse manner, have reused for at least 15 years. The investigation of these sorts of relationships begins with identification of similar passages using sequence alignment, which is a technique that's used in other domains to find different strings of similarity. So it's used a lot in bioinformatics to think about similar DNA sequences, plagiarism detection, which I've mentioned, and then inversely in text collation, so looking for zones of variance into liked traditions. We were inspired, Mark Olson in particular, Artful at the time, was inspired by the bioinformatic approach of sequence alignment. This is still in use today. Colleagues in Helsinki are here that use the BLAST algorithm, which comes directly out of the bioinformatic world. At Artful, we've developed, Mark Olson and now Clovis Gladstone, who is here, our own system called TextPair. This is as technical as I'll get today. It's not very technical at all. But this is it gives you an idea of what TextPair does, what the system does. We take large databases, we pre-treat them, turn them in what's called n-grams, so groups of words. We look for the common sequences of these n-grams, and then we adjust parameters. There's a high flexibility. Again, plagiarism detection is a bit too strict. What we're interested in, especially in my new project, is zones of where the same text is there, but there might be changes or errors or things you can jump out of. So this idea of flexible parameters is very important. And so if you take the first two lines of Rousseau's social contract, l'homme est né libre par tous les données faire, this is how we pre-treat the document. It becomes homme libre partout faire. You can see how this works. The idea being that homme libre partout, if shared between two documents that are not the same document, is a fairly rare event. And given the rarity of this event, the algorithm will then think about are there other n-grams shared either to the left or right in a sliding window that we define. So this is a deceptively straightforward notion of intertextuality. It's the same set text, more or less, in two different places. But as you'll see today, the range of text reuse, the detection of reuses is only the first step. And in fact, it's understanding how these reuses are employed and deployed in the 18th century that it becomes really interesting. So for example, there's no real surprise that the Encyclopédie cites or uses Pierre Bayle. It was a known predecessor of the Encyclopédie. And we find a very long segment at the end of the article on Spinoza. But what is surprising is that at the end of the article, the Abbé Yvon finishes in Bayle's voice. So he concludes the article in a je finis par dire. So there's no quotation marks. Bayle is mentioned at the beginning. So there's something going on here. But it's a way of sort of putting Bayle in the encyclopedie. His voice becomes part of the authorial fingerprint of the encyclopedie. So he concludes the article. Whether or not the readers of the time knew this, it remains to be seen. But for us, it was a clear indication that we had no idea what was going on here until the computer found this match. It can do. We found this with lots of different works. So, for example, the idea of using Locke in the Encyclopedia is really, really interesting, and we can do this using text from Echo, which is a translation, obviously. And using Locke in the Encyclopédie was a bold move. Locke's second treatise was in France banned and burned. It was on the index. So if you said, I'm going to cite Locke, chances are the censor would come and say, no, either take it out or you'll lose your privilege. But Jaucourt is a man possessed, and he says, I'm going to use Locke. I just won't tell anybody what's going on here. And so all through the article, gouvernement is lots and lots of Locke. With no indication whatsoever that this is where it comes from. And again, it's more or less, it's not a copier-coller. It's not that he's taking a bit of Locke and just pasting it in for an article. It's that he's weaving it into his own articles to support his own arguments. And this is very much how text reuse worked in the 18th century as a way of generating meaning through the use of other models. This caused us to think about the status of different works. What works could you cite in the Encyclopédie? What couldn't? You could cite the Henriade, for example, less controversial, but you could never cite, or you shouldn't ever cite, the Lettre Philosophique, because again, like Locke, it was banned and burned. And then there was a whole sort of spectrum of dangerous works that would make their way into the Encyclopédie. It was really stupid to think about citing De l'Esprit, because De l'Esprit from Helvetius, in fact, causes the Encyclopédie to lose its privilege because of its association with materialism. But once again, Jaucourt he is quite insistent. So he uses a bit of De l'Esprit in his article on La Cité des Moines, but he gives a tip of the hat here. He says to people, oh, here it is. There's no quotation marks. There's just this passage, and he says, c'est dit un beau génie de ce siècle. So it's up to the reader to understand, who is this beau génie? What's going on? Is it? Would they recognize this as Helvétius? Not so sure. It's true there's a whole system of coding that goes on in the encyclopedia. So l'historien philosophe is Voltaire. Le plus grand génie du siècle is Montesquieu. There's lots of different other ways of referring to people. But this is, again, a case where perhaps the readers of the 18th century saw what was going on. Not so sure. Readers today certainly do not. Some specialists maybe. But it's a real area where the computer can bring us to new knowledge. And this was published, of course, with Dan Edelstein and Robert Morrissey. And then we continued along this vein, thinking about hidden voices in the Encyclopedia, which is a polyphonic work, as you saw with the sort of incorporation of Bale. Maybe we know there's 140 authors, but maybe there's many, many, many more that we just don't know about. And one of these, of course, was Émilie du Châtelet. And somebody knew that the article Hypothèse was, in fact, drawn more or less from her Institution de Physique. And so we digitized, or we took a digitized version of the Institution de Physique, and we compared it to the Encyclopédie. And what was it? It was really interesting. We found, I think, 13 articles with at least some Émilie du Châtelet. She's, of course, not an author. There's only one female author in the Encyclopédie. And Diderot refers to her as an anonymous woman. It's a bit sad. We think it's Jocour's wife. It's an article on fashion. That's the only woman in the Encyclopédie. But nonetheless, you can see that some of these articles, and we've given them a score, as in how much du Châtelet is in there. Contradiction is 95% du Châtelet. The reason that Formé is mentioned everywhere is that there was this guy named Samuel Formé, who was the secretary of the Academy of Berlin. And he was going to make his own dictionary. And then he heard about Diderot and D'Alembert, and he got discouraged. And so he gives his papers to D'Alembert, and he says, do what you want with them. But in fact, he just cribs and steals from Émilie du Châtelet in many places. And so D'Alembert doesn't quite know that what's going on, and so he puts this into the Encyclopédie. But in fact, all these articles continue, for example. D'Alembert says these come from the papers of Samuel Formé, but it's Émilie du Châtelet. So this sort of gives us this notion of there are these articles that should rightly somehow, or we should somehow mention Émilie du Châtelet as being at least a co-author with these others. And then recently, or somewhat recently, we thought about translation as reuse. So if you know sort of the history of the Encyclopédie, it started out as a translation project of the English Cyclopedia of Ephraim Chambers. And then eventually, quickly, it got out of hand, and they decided, well, it's going to be much more than just a translation. But they had this block of text of translations of articles that were started by different people, and we're never quite sure where they occur in the Encyclopédie. You know? There are articles that have a mention, and here Paolo Quinti says that many times they left these articles and just used them as filler, almost unchanged without significant modifications. But there's never been a sort of systematic undertaking of how to find these articles. Some are marked with this end reference to Chambers. There's about 1,100 of these. And this is a good article. Gynocracy, the law by women. And you can see what we wanted to do was somehow draw this connection between the Chambers at the bottom and the Encyclopédie at the top. And at the time, I think it was 2018, 2019, it was before these great multilingual language models. So I'm sure now, today, we could do it much more easily. Clovis probably has different ways. But we did it in a pretty hand-cranked way, as we say it, as we digitized the 1742 Chambers, which was the Chambers that Diderot owned. We ran it through Google Translate automatically, and we kept the structure, and we built a virtual dictionary, a sort of fake French Chambers. And with that French Chambers, we ran the sequence alignment against it to find articles. So for example, Gynocracy comes back, and we had to really get fine-grained on our comparisons, because obviously, it's a modern translation. So, for example, it totally has no idea what a petticoat government might or might not be. It's a un petit manteau gouvernement. So it makes no sense whatsoever. It's a terrible translation. But there's enough n-grams, there's enough content in there that we're able to get a match. And again, it was already signed by Chambers, and we only found about 800 of the 1,100. So it could be due to translation, it could be due to lots of different things. But we found like 2,500 more articles that had no mention to Chambers whatsoever. So for example, our friend the Abbé Mallet writes the article Démoniaque, which is a word for word, the same amount of paragraphs, the same cross-references as Chambers. It's taken clearly directly from Chambers, and he signs his name to it. So again, is this a Chambers article, or is this the Abbé Mallet? Moving on, this is sort of to give you a very synthetic view of how we envision text reuse detection. We're progressively moving out of the encyclopedie and into the sort of larger communication world of print culture in the 18th century. This is Robert Darnton's famous communication network. And the idea here is that information flows in the 18th century through all sorts of different channels. Oddly enough, correspondence doesn't show up on his communication network, which I've always found a bit odd. But again, this goes back to our time here, my time here in Oxford with Nicholas. One of the first ideas we had was electronic enlightenment, correspondence in general, should be really rich for text reuse. There should be some sort of platform in which text reuse is filtered through this information space that is at one time sociable, but also a way of diffusing information, a way of building literary authority, and otherwise. So we all know electronic enlightenment. And to give you an example of how this sort of thing can work with correspondence, we can take an event like the earthquake in Lisbon in 1755. It happens in November 1st. And we know that Voltaire gets news of this, gets wind of this, and it sort of shakes his faith in an optimistic worldview, in divine providence, as it were. And he writes a poem. and we find traces of the poem already in January 1756. So it's very fast in terms of early modern. And it's just a little bit. And it's someone that writes to Van Halle, who says, well, I was in his presence, and he recited this poem, and I have these last eight verses. And it's a very funny letter, because he says, he wrote this poem, I was sent the eight verses which enclose here. I have reason to believe that it, in his own admission, it seemed to me these were a little materialistic. And I've replied... But there's no indication here. I've replied with a few fragments of my own translation of Van Haller's work on the Origine du Mal. So this is a sort of Frankenstein poem here that is eight lines of Voltaire, eight lines of a translation of Van Haller's work, which he does directly into the correspondence. So this is this poetics of text reuse that's being. And if we compare the eight lines by Voltaire, we can see this is, we talked about this afternoon, this idea of at some point you get to the end point of these reuses, you want to see what the differences are rather than the similarities. And in this case, the last two lines don't make it into the final cut. And because we're using modern text from the Voltaire Foundation, we wouldn't get this end of this couplet, que faut-il au mortel, il faut souffrir, se soumettre en silence, adorer et mourir. So Voltaire thought this was a bit depressing, and he doesn't continue on with it. But it's a way of recreating this sort of notion of he's creating through the correspondence, he's creating different ways, he's retouching his work, and eventually the sequences get longer as we go on. And so by March, it's much longer. And it's another letter to Van Haller where he says, I was in the presence and he gave cette pièce retouchée. So we know it's a retouch piece. And again, here we can show that more or less it's the same version, right? There's a few differences, providence and puissance has been changed, suprême, je lève. But again, this can tell you how the correspondence is really interesting to see different states of a work which don't quite make it into editions or might not make it into editions, but good ones they will. Finally, then we know as a sort of media event, somebody sends the letter to Rousseau and says, what are you going to let this guy question divine providence? And of course Rousseau is always up to the challenge, and he responds with this really long letter, which is about 6,000 words, which gets printed as On Optimism and sort of flies all over Europe. Voltaire is not very happy about this, that his letter was printed. And so we can only assume that one of the responses to this in the same year that On Optimism was published is probably Candide. So again, this way of thinking of reuse as a way of augmenting or understanding cultural dissemination. And also, I'd be remiss not to mention just the way that Voltaire reads and reads with his correspondence, which is really interesting. He was like a Reader's Digest, and he loved to accept works and he'd send it to his friends. So here, Delhomme is another Helvetius works. It's published posthumously, 1771 or 1773. Here, Voltaire is taking little snippets out of it, sending it to D'Alembert and saying, oh, don't you think this is great? It's too bad it's actually a pretty bad book. he does the same thing for Madame du Deffand, which is nice because she's blind. So he's sort of saying here, I'm giving you all of the good parts. Don't waste your time with the book. It's a bad book, but I've given you the good things. And he says, I take these little diamonds at random, madam. There are 1,000 of this taste whose brilliance struck me. That does not prevent the book from being very bad. I spend my life looking for precious stones in manure. And when I find some, I put them aside and make a profit from them. That's why bad books are sometimes very useful. So here, in a nutshell, is the sort of text-reuse poetics of the 18th century. So this is notion of somehow you accrue through this dissemination of both the act of extracting these precious diamonds from books, but also sending them out. So we can't pick it up unless somebody sends it out. So text reuse can only help you in this moment that somebody reuses the text again. But again, it's a whole question. So we have writer's notebooks, for example. So Voltaire knows he has his notebooks. So these are the things that he writes down, these quotations. So how, what's the moment that the quote he decides a quotation is going to move out into the world? And so all of this to move finally to the new project we have now, which is to think precisely about this whole sort of network or this whole sort of realm or cultural system that is the 18th century based on reuses. So we want to think about intertextual networks. Don't worry too much about this network. They all sort of look like giant hairballs when you do it. But Voltaire's always in the middle. That's just because, as I said, he was a real text reuser. And this project called Modern that Nicholas mentioned is based on this notion that perhaps we can think about the exchange of text reuses. So not just identifying the reuses, that's the first step, but thinking about how the reuses travel and are used and reused through networks. And so borrowing from work from Dan Edelstein, who started sort of looking into networks at Stanford with the Mapping the Republic of Letters project, more recently thinking about social network analysis as a way of understanding cultural exchange through different areas. And here Ruth and Sebastian Anhert have been instrumental in promoting this approach in the humanities. They have a wonderful new book out I recommend to everyone called Tudor Networks of Power. There were also, of course, an Oxford Studies collection by Dan and Chloe Edmondson thinking about how to use text social network analysis for the humanities. And a good primer, again, is by Ruth and Sebastian with Catherine Coleman and Scott Weingart, The Network Turn. For my own part, to keep this notion of theorizing into it, I add a sort of extra layer of what Bruno Latour calls the actor network theory. And here, the way we think about this with the networks that we want to build, the two advantages of actor network theory, one is that there's no presuppositions, there's no a priori's. You simply generate these networks and you try to trace where the data takes you. So it's very online with what we call data-driven research. You build the data sets, you run the algorithms over it. What comes out, then you try to make sense of. And also within this sort of intellectual framework of actor network theory, actors can be anything. They need not be human beings. They can be books, they can be texts, they can be snippets, they can be speed bumps, as Bruno Latour tells us. It's anything that affects the behavior or the predicted behavior of a network. And another important takeaway from this is that sometimes it's not the originators nor the receivers, but it's the mediators that are in fact the most important nodes in a network. But to do this, of course, we have to have a lot of data. And this is what we've been doing for the past couple of years, compiling lots and lots of data as much as we can get in the 18th century realm, with the only caveat being that we don't digitize anything. So the idea is that digitized collections are significantly sufficient now that we should use them. And that because, yes, there are lots of errors, and because, yes, they come from OCR, there are errors, we should nonetheless use them. So we've taken a mixture of corrected works, which we call canon, so the distinction is only qualitative, and archive, which are OCR. So we have about 12,400 books in this main collection, which we will then compare iteratively through pamphlets, letters, dictionaries, and finally the press, which we're working on with the BNF. And the notion here is to think about to that communication network of Darnton, that it's not just books that are important in the 18th century, but how they move through things like pamphlets, letters, and especially the press. Very interesting. To have a think about just scale, I think now we have some notion that the press will be about 300 million words. So we're up to 1 billion words, which is completely arbitrary, but it's what I said in my grant proposal, that we get 1 billion words. But the idea being that with 1 billion words, you can build your own data, your own large language model for the 18th century. So we can think about how, either fine-tune one, but maybe we can ask Voltaire some questions through the language model that we built. Nonetheless, so what? Who cares? Oh, this is the question I tell my students, just put it in. So what? So what? What can we do then? We have all this data. We're going to run these alignments. We're going to have to filter them, but that's a story for another time. The first thing we want to do is just simply supplement traditional methods. It's just new ways of doing what historians have always done, but on steroids in some sense, in a way that's both faster and perhaps more comprehensive. So it will contain the modern database will contain a great number of these intertextual reuses, make it possible to sort of follow the fortunes of intertext or concepts as they move through this information space. This is very much the sort of conservative side of intertextuality come from Harold Bloom. So to take one example, we have Boileau, who writes Rien n'est beau que le vrai sur le tamable. But this is very much an aesthetic judgment. It's talking about verisimilitude. It's about how a text, a fiction, has to be sort of true for people to embrace it. And you can sort of follow it as it moves through the 18th century. And so Condillac brings it up, but in speaking about imagination. So it's still very much aesthetic, this notion that it's still verisimilitude, but he's talking about the imagination and how the imagination forms in fables and fictions, etc. By the time you get to Samuel Constant de Rebec, he repeats it, he has quotation marks, it's good. But he undermines completely Boileau. And he says, rien n'est beau que le vrai sur le tamam, quoi que celui qui l'a dit n'ait jamais écrit un mot de vérité. So even though the person that wrote it never wrote a word of truth. And then by the time we get to the revolution, there's this interesting text, which I'll talk about here shortly, called Les Pensées Républicaines. You can see that there's no indication at all that it's Boileau. No idea that's Boileau. The text is there. But just by its context, you can see that it's changed into a moral category. This true, this vrai, is very different from the beginning vrai, from Boileau. And so by this time, it's changed completely in its valence. So that's just one example of what you could do with our data set. Secondly, this gets to what Nicholas was mentioning earlier, in a sense of distant reading, we hope we can really sort of remap the literary history of the 18th century, using these sort of social network analysis and how they move through the different thing. And this sort of presupposes a sort of radical notion of intertextuality, where everything is an intertext. And in fact, it's more about this process of dissemination, Bach tells us, not of reproduction, but of productivity. So an intertext or a cluster of intertext is a productive force. Sometimes without an author, without any reference to intentionality, it's just these reuses that sort of move through these texts. And so we have to sort of think about different ways of thinking about authorship, how we understand authors in this text. And for us, it's just one attribute of a text object. So the text is primordial for us, the text that circulates, that moves its way through. If we know the author, great. If we don't, it's all right. We hope to find it at some point. And these attributes then can be derived from other relationships between text objects. And then an author object, if we talk about author objects in our networks, it's the result of the combination of all these different characteristics attributed to it by the relations between the text objects. So this is a sort of, an author is important, not because of what we read about literary history, but it's their place in the network and their sort of lines of force as reusers. This also causes us to think about what's a text. Very prosaically for us, a text is a sort of concordance of at least four similar trigrams that follow within a defined interval. But this poses all sorts of questions, and all reuses are not equal. So for example, this comes from Dario Nicolosi, who found this great example of Marat during the revolution reuses, whether consciously, I mean, whether on purpose or not, we don't know, it doesn't really matter, Fénelon. So you would never join these two together. He changes it a bit. The Lion de Numidie becomes Tigre. But the context is completely different. I mean, it's just, it couldn't be clearer. And so here we're saying, this is what we want. This is exactly what we want. But nonetheless, in the bottom here, and the titles are the same, and we'd say this is really interesting. But if you look at the text, it's not interesting at all. It's a reuse. It's an intertext. You can't say it has an author. It circulates. It has some value, but we're not quite sure what. So this sort of gets us into this notion. And this is exactly, we've been trotting out this notion of Barthes for 15 years, but we never quite got to the end of the quotation. And then he says, in fact, intertextuality is a condition of any text whatsoever. It's obviously not reducible to a problem of source and influences, which is what we've always thought. Intertext is a general field of anonymous formulas, the origin of which is rarely identifiable, of unconscious or automatic quotations given without inverted commas. So this is, how do you find that? How do you understand that? What does that mean? And how can we implement that into our networks? And then finally, to come back to Genet, he says, in fact, some texts are really, really hypertextual. And this is before Tim Berners-Lee, so it's a theoretical hypertext. There's no literary work that, to some degree, and depending on the reading, does not evoke another. And in this sense, all works are hypertextual. But like Orwell's Equals in Animal Farm, some are more hypertextual, more obviously, massively, and explicitly than others. The Encyclopédie is one of these. Diderot's, Voltaire's Question sur l'Encyclopédie is one of these hypertextual works. And we find them again and again in popping up. The Pensée républicaine, this is a beginning, a sort of very preliminary look at network measures. It kept popping up. We didn't even know what it was. It was just in our corpora. And then we looked at it and we said, oh, well, this makes perfect sense why it would be there and why it would have these high scores, because it's a text reuse machine. And he writes it in at the very beginning of the revolution. And he says, I'm offering it to these students, all these little maxims, all these little pensées, and you have one a day that you're meant to read and think about and ruminate on. And it's for the entire Republican calendar. And so, again, we thought, well, this is really interesting. We should be able to find more than we thought. But in fact, it was a lot of work, and Dario had to do a lot of hand-checking for these different things. But we can find the sort of modern sources. There's a lot of Rousseau. There's some Benjamin Franklin. There's some Duclos. There's a history of China. So it's very syncretic in its sort of where these come from. But there's a whole mass of maxims of reuses that we can't identify and that remain unidentifiable. And so if you just take one day, so this is the first decade of one decade of Frimaire, you can see the different sort of pensées that go through here. We haven't found. It goes from Benjamin Franklin to Voltaire to Bruyère, back to Franklin, Sénèque, Benjamin Franklin, Duclos, etc. So it's a really fascinating work. It causes you to go in and really get into the text, which Dario has proclaimed as due close reading, so a sort of lovely pun on close reading. But it's interesting to see how these transformations happen. Again, there's no indication of the author in this text. There's just the reuse. But you can see that there's certain changes that happen for whatever reason. In this case, in the first case, with the history of Louis XII, un et homme is changed into uni à l'intérêt commun, changes completely the text. It's a different text. So it's still Duclos, is it? Is it different? Who does it belong to? What does it mean? Secondly, le génie a ses bornes. So this goes back to this notion of originality. L'esprit a ses bornes et ses cartes. So it's more about rationalism, less than originality. So this is the sort of hypertextual text, and it gets really wild if you move it out. Here we have two lines from Le Cid: "Mourir pour le pays n'est pas une triste sort, c'est s'immortaliser par une belle mort." Two lines from L'Henriade: "Du comment un enfant l'étonnant aventure ira de bouche en bouche à la race future." In the sixth decade of Brumaire, Pensée number 30, you have both these lines that have been melded together. Mourir pour son pays n'est pas une triste chose, si si mort est-il pour une belle mort. De Barra, so Paul Barra shows up out of nowhere, is thrown in there. Jeune encore, l'étonnant aventure de ira de bouche en bouche à la race future. So it's a completely, who does this play? Is this Corneille? Is this Voltaire? What is Barra doing there? What's going on? So again, this is the computer takes you only so far, and then you have to just sort of think about what's going on. And then finally, another text that's popped up, which is completely crazy, and I'll end on this, is this text by Jean-Marie Chassaignon, who's completely unknown. It's too bad Katrina Seth isn't here today. She might be one of the few people with Michel Delon who actually knows who this person is, because it showed up in her anthology of French poetry from 2000. And he's a sort of illuminé. He's one of the illuminists around Mesmer. He comes from Lyon. And he writes this insane book called The Cataracts of the Imagination, Flood of Scribomania, Literary Vomissement, Encyclopedic Hemorrhage, Monster of Monsters by Epimenides, the Inspired, who publishes Dans l'Antre de Trophimus. So that, I don't know how you would critically edit that text. Where do you put it? Where do you map that? Au pays des visions, well, it gets a little more specific. And it's an insane book, but it's really interesting because I think it's the culmination of this really open poetics of reuse for the 18th century. And he has this preface qui n'en est pas une. So it's he says, I'm not going to write a preface. And then he writes 100 pages of preface, where he says, I'm just weaving together here prose and verse. I call on all the annals to my aid. I call on all the authors. I review them as the new dictator of the literary republic. I indulge in the factious who make the snakes, etc. So you get sort of where he's going. My pamphlet fleshed out, it's four volumes, by the way, not quite a pamphlet, fleshed out in this way with historical traits swollen with dissimulations of the mind, studded with quotations of all kinds, becomes a literary mosaic. So this goes back to what I said at the beginning. And you can see it. He takes great inspiration from one, Montaigne, because he said Montaigne is great because he'll put a chapter title and then he'll give you a chapter that has nothing to do with the title, and he thinks that's amazing. And Pierre Bayle. So you can see the sort of inspiration from Bayle in all of his notes, notes to notes. So he has one phrase, one sentence here. Je vole donc au lieu où vous êtes, qui devient un sanctuaire pour moi. There's an asterisk note. There's another note that goes on for two more pages, just commenting himself. And he's both his own. So it's a fantastic work. Sometimes he cites where it comes from. Other times there's nothing. So again, it's this machine, it's a sort of text reuse machine. I won't read all of his quotes, but he gets really into this notion of how he's building with all the different, all these different types of texts, what he calls, we have to build a type of encyclopedia. So he's taking up this notion of the encyclopedia, as we come back to it. We have to use this idea of universality with a multiplicity of their talents, this is the poet, to throw into the same work the salt of the epigram, the roses of adulation, the nettles of satire, every genre, every author, the entire 18th century should come to bear on this text. And he continues on this bizarre overflowing, so it's this sort of expansion of wandering thoughts and hidden passages, does not require a very strange effort of the imagination. Imaginative, which I wasn't quite sure what that word is in French. With dictionaries, collections, patient copyists, and time, the most limited scribe is capable of populating the literary universe with encyclopedic monsters. So to echo our times, with the right tools, the right large language model, the right resources, we too can build these sorts of poetic model monsters. And perhaps that's precisely what language models like GPT are, encyclopedic monsters. Diderot, of course, already foresaw this monstrosity in the making of his Encyclopédie. When he took stock of their universal text in 1755, far from the perfect system of human understanding that was proposed by D'Alembert in the preface, in the Discours Préliminaire, what they had was uneven, unwieldy, and ultimately uncontrollable. The proof can be found in 100 places in this work. Here we are bloated and exorbitantly fat. There we are lean, petty, pathetic, dry, and scrawny. In one place we are skeletal, in another we rather seem dropsical. We are by turns dwarves and giants, colossus and pygmies, standing straight, nicely built, and well-proportioned, hunchbacked, lame, and deformed. Add to all these quirks that of a text which is sometimes abstract, recondite, and mannered, more often careless, drawn out, and diffuse, and you will compare the work to a monster of the poetic art, or even to something more hideous yet. As the predecessor to Wikipedia, and perhaps even the internet, or at the very least the World Wide Web, and in direct lineage with the other imaginary machines of Charles Babbage and Ada Lovelace, of Alan Turing, of Vannevar Bush, the poetics of reuse enacted by the Encyclopédie, and indeed, as we've seen over the entirety of the 18th century, is a resolutely modern, if not to say contemporary, phenomenon. And we who live now amongst the encyclopedic monsters of AI would then do well not to forget our history. To return very briefly to our illuminated poet, I tried to find more information of him in 19th century biographies, so the great France Littéraire. It just says he was born and died, and it gives a list of his work. But at the very end, there's a very curious note where it says, Monsieur Chassignon left behind many a manuscript, which his brother, a grocer in Lyon, used to wrap the medicines in his shop. Clearly, this is yet another example, perhaps not so much intractable in computational terms, of the poetics of text reuse. Thank you very much.